Hey, it's Chaz Mostard here, and yes, I'm inside your speaker. I'm in here because I have a special message for you from Clayton in Melbourne. If you're a club, state, or national racer on the circuit or on the dirt in Speedway or rallying, you can now tap into the know-how of Walkinshaw Racing Services, and you don't need a supercar to get in the door. The same expertise that's won multiple Bathurst 1000s and V8 Supercar Championships is now available for you to call upon. From bonnet to bumper, WRS can help you with engines, design, paint, machining, fabrication, and so much more for all sorts of makes, models, and categories. Have a chat with Walkinshaw Racing Services and tell them what matters to you. Call now on 1300 W Racing or email services@walkinshawracing.com.au.
A Motorsport Podcast Network production.
G'day race fans, welcome to the Motorsport News Podcast. I'm your host Will Dale, and here's what's making headlines this week. The first Repco Supercars Championship round at Taupo International Motorsport Park has been a resounding success. We'll unpick the on-track action soon, but the event drew a massive crowd. 67,411 people came through the gates across all 3 days at the ITM Taupo Super 400, notwithstanding the dire weather on the Saturday, with drivers equating the fan engagement and response with the Bathurst 1000. A bit of news from the Ford camp over the weekend. Longtime engine guru Bobby Irvin has left Motorsport Powertrains, the outfit that runs the engine program for every Mustang on the supercars grid. Irvin's been with the company since its days as MosTech, through its Herod Performance Engines iteration last year and into the early months under Dick Johnson Racing ownership this year, but finished up with them after the Australian Grand Prix. Meanwhile, many of the Fords were running a new spec oil pump at Taupo, the bespoke unit replacing modified parts used up to this point in the wake of revisions to the Coyote engine over the off-season, while the Fords and the Chevys also ran revised engine maps last weekend. Cam Waters has locked in his second NASCAR start, returning to the Craftsman Truck Series for the Kansas race next month. He'll be back in the number 66 Ford F-150 at Thor Sport Racing. Despite reports of the drive being locked in while he was still in the middle of his Martinsville debut, it was contingent on NASCAR approving him to race on a high-speed track, and that has now happened. The race on May the 4th falls a fortnight before the next Supercars round at Wanneroo. Hidden Valley is set to get a major upgrade to its pit facilities. The Northern Territory government has allocated $3 million in its upcoming budget to roll out the rest of the first stage of the Hidden Valley Master Plan, including upgrades to the pit area, a new control tower and medical centre, as well as a new entrance to the circuit. But the initial round of upgrades will be focused on making the circuit more accessible, giving fans with a disability improved facilities, upgraded pathways, new lighting and better signage. And Supercars is getting into the used car business. Well, kind of, anyway. They've put the two Gen 3 prototypes up for sale through Youngtimers Garage. They're the original Ford Mustang and Chevrolet Camaro that did all the testing and demonstration runs during 2021 and 2022, but they can't actually be raced due to changes made to the chassis specs prior to Gen 3 being signed off for 2023. Supercars hasn't announced a price, but I think you'd be wanting to find every last cent from between your couch cushions and then some. Joining me is V8 Sleuth's head of publications, Stefan Bartholomaeus. And Stefan, after all the build-up, all the hype and all the fanfare around Supercars' return to New Zealand, are you any more certain about the correct way to pronounce Taupo? Because I'm certainly not.
Hello, Will. I did notice there are a few different versions of that getting a run on the TV coverage. I'm still going with Taupo like you are, but normally with a bit of a pause for thought in front of it.
Yes. For anyone who is also uncertain, there is a very helpful video on Taupo's YouTube page, their tourism YouTube page, which is entertaining and informative, which is the best kind. Right, let's start with our Autobahn aces from the Supercars action over the weekend over in New Zealand. So, for my Autobahn ace of the week, well, it's whoever was responsible for this little piece in the TV broadcast prior to the Boost Mobile Top 10 shootout.
It's time for the Boost Mobile Top 10 shootout.
So yeah, if you didn't actually catch that during the coverage, that was Brody Kostecki saying the words Boost Mobile, which I don't know whether anyone would have necessarily forecast a couple of weeks ago when it was announced that he was returning to the championship with Erebus Motorsport, but doing so without any form of his Boost Mobile personal sponsorship and, of course, all the things that Peter Adderton wrote on social media afterwards. So I'm handing my Autobahn ace to whoever managed to pull that little swindle over the weekend.
Well, the Erebus release announcing that Brody was going to return did say it would be a boost for the team, which seemed like some Olympic-level trolling. But we'll move past that. My Autobahn ace from the weekend just gone is Tony Quinn for not only hosting the circus for the first time at his Taupo track, but winning the Sunday race as a co-owner of Triple Eight. He actually claimed afterwards that he's the first one to do that, track owner, race winner, double. Have you run a fact check on that?
I don't know if it stacks up. Not taking anything away from Quinny, because what he achieved over the weekend was phenomenal, and getting to flip off the metaphorical knockers during the post-race presser was fantastic as well, and doing so on live TV, as it turned out. So I have there's only really one possible candidate as to who could challenge him for this, and it's Bob Jane, who, of course, owned Calder Park. The Jane family still owns Calder Park. Of course, Bob, quite the notable racer and team owner himself, won the Calder round in 1972 in his own car. And I'd need to double check whether he owned it at that point. I have a feeling he did. So keep an eye on the V8 Sleuth website, I guess, during the week. And hopefully I'll have an answer.
It's a shame that TQ Taupo wildcard that got announced on April the 1st wasn't announced on another date, because that would have been spectacular if he'd actually had a skid. But in all seriousness, like, it looked like Tony and his whole team there at Taupo did an amazing job to present that facility and host the round the way they did.
So our Autobahn aces do give us a nice little segue into the weekend's action. As you said, like as I said in the headlines, a massive crowd at Taupo as well. It's like half of New Zealand turned up to watch the supercars over the weekend, despite getting almost flooded out on the Saturday. The Kiwis really do love supercars racing, and they got quite a good show.
Well, yeah, I mean, from a few weeks out when they'd announced that the GA tickets were sold out, it was clear that it was going to be a healthy-looking crowd, and it did look packed on TV, even in the rain, like, which is a credit to the Kiwi fans for turning up despite those conditions. I guess it's contextual as well, because the figure they announced was like 67,000 for the weekend, which, like, Pukekohe was over 100,000. But they're obviously limited there at Taupo on capacity. But, yeah, that track layout, the way it turns in on itself, means the fans are sort of like – all put in pretty much one or two zones. So it looks great on TV, and most of all, really, with the racetrack, just produced two cracking races.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that absolutely enhanced how we view the event in the aftermath. The circuit itself, it's interesting to think that this is the kind of place where supercars is headed, because it kind of reminds me of like the old school heritage style Australian venues that the sport has stopped going to in the last few years. It's kind of a bit like a Winton or a QR or even a Calder Park, in the sense of that, like, it's a small action track where crowds can see most of the circuit, turns on pretty good racing. It's funny to think that that's what they've achieved over in New Zealand, and whether some of the lessons that they've learned over the last few weeks could maybe be applied to an Australian event like that.
Well, it's so rare that supercars goes to a permanent circuit that it hasn't been to before, especially within Australasia. Like, you take the Bend out, the last new or first-time visit to an Aussie circuit was obviously Queensland Raceway, like 25 years ago, permanent tracks, that is. But certainly when you looked at that layout and how tight and twisty a lot of it is, there was a real fear that they would be very processional races and there'd be very little overtaking. But that aggressive track surface and the tyre deg that it brought, which people knew, like, they'd gone over and scoped it out beforehand, drivers and engineers. So there was a lot of awareness of that. But that really added to the show in terms of the dry race on the Sunday. I mean, we even saw some three-stop strategies which not very often you see in that sort of scenario, to see a really different out-of-the-box strategy there. So, yeah, that was great. And then the corner types just produced some passing probably in a couple of places we didn't expect as well, like that area into turn five, which is where Will Brown ultimately got Brock Feeney. Like, it's really tight through there, but we saw several passes across the weekend.
Full marks to Greg Murphy. He actually called that at the start of the weekend in terms of places where, maybe you could potentially see a pass there if someone wanted to have a real dive. The other one that comes to mind from, I'm pretty sure it was the same corner, was that where Ryan Wood had that huge go at Thomas Randall and sprayed it across the front early in race two?
There were so many things going on across those two races that it's hard to remember every incident. But, yeah, I spoke to Murph for a yarn in the official program that we put together, and he did mention a couple of passing spots, and I'm looking at the track map going, oh, I don't know, brother. But, yeah, you should always listen to the king of the local area, because he nailed it.
He sure did. I guess the next significant talking point from the weekend is that battle that we had on Sunday afternoon between the two 888 cars. It's the first time in quite a while we've seen those two entries going head-to-head in such a heated battle for a win, and the first time we've seen Brock Feeney and his new teammate, Will Brown, going for it. Of course, we all know that Will Brown got the edge on the incumbent driver of the 88 car. Here's what they had to say, each had to say after the race.
Yeah, it was an awesome race. I'm not sure what was going on in the pits. I'm sure the guys were a bit nervous. Yeah, it was hard to make the pass. You know, there's not heaps of passing opportunities, and I had to set it up, and I got stuck there for a while. So I was getting hot tires and all of that. So just got it done, and luckily we didn't collide or run into each other or anything like that. So hopefully I won't get fired on Monday. But no, it seemed pretty good. I think it was good racing. We might have touched once, but apart from that, it was awesome. Oh, really? No, we didn't touch.
You do have to be careful. If we do come together, there is going to be pretty big ramifications, I think, on Monday morning. But look, I think we race probably as hard as we could, and being super respectful, not rubbing panels all the time and that. You're probably going to rub someone up a little bit more when it's not your teammate. But look, obviously I would have liked to stay in front, but I think the racing that we put on this afternoon was pretty awesome. It was good fun for a tight little twisty track. We had some pretty cool moves going on, so it was good fun. Obviously, you know, you got someone that you trust with Will. I think the engineers are probably a little bit more stressed out than we were in the car. We were just having a bit of fun, so yeah, it was a good race. Obviously I'd rather come out in front, but I'm pretty pumped for the team.
Steph, there are a few nervous faces in the 888 bunker in the heat of that battle. You reckon they were getting a few flashbacks from the Shane Van Gisbergen and Jamie Wincup days, or the Jamie Wincup Craig Lowndes days for that matter?
Yeah, I mean, it's just great that 888 let the drivers race that hard. Like, there's no doubt some other teams out there would have called off that fight, but 888 really has been about race but don't make contact, which is a dangerous rule, because if you race as hard as they were, inevitably sometimes the teammates will make contact, and that's the sort of instances you've just alluded to there before, that it has happened in the past. But these two on Sunday, they just drove it right to the edge and did such a good job in that battle, like both of them. And ultimately in the pass that Will made, like, Brock does open it a bit for him, and Will's got the rears locked, and he's just so close to having some contact. But they handled it well on the track, and then even afterwards, like, Brock, you know, he handled that all pretty well, and it's just such an exciting battle for us all to watch. Like, Will Brown has just come in and laid down a marker within that race team. Like, any talk that this was Brock's team and, like, Will was going to be sort of an outsider trying to go up against him, I mean, it's just been rubbish. Like, 888 really doesn't work that way. They're an open book, same equipment, info shared, and at the moment, that 87 side of the garage is doing a slightly better job.
It'll be fascinating to see how Brock responds to this, because, I mean, there wasn't some big tyre advantage for Will Brown in that battle. He pitted one lap later. It was one lap, and he just had nothing for him. So, realistically, The race itself was kind of mirrors how the title battle is going at the moment. Like, the closest car, Anton DiPasquale, was 15 seconds behind them. This title chase, realistically, is between those two Red Bull drivers, And like you said, Will Brown really has the edge on Brock Feeney at the moment.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll ebb and flow through the season. Brock's obviously a very high-quality driver and he's very dedicated to finding success. And this is a big opportunity for him without Shane Van Gisbergen there in the other car. So, yeah, I don't think he'll be massively rattled by it, but it's certainly a more exciting battle than some of us thought. And we've seen also on the Saturday, like, Triple Eight did mess it up. Like, they had some issues there, not selecting the right tyre pressures for the wet running, and they had a bit of a struggle. So, yeah, it's a close battle.
Bless them for doing so too, because that made the Saturday race a lot more exciting, I hate to say. The other key storyline heading into the weekend, of course, the man who has been the big storyline throughout the entire season so far, even though he hasn't been here until last weekend, Brody Kostecki, back with Erebus Motorsport, back in the championship, wearing the number one. I kind of found his return weekend a little underwhelming, but I guess that's not that surprising given he's not been in the car all year.
Yeah, certainly. It's in hindsight not surprising that he ran sort of where he did. I mean, there was a bit of an expectation that he'd be straight back on it. And that was fueled a little bit too by some of the comments, I think, from Barry Ryan around the test day and from Brody himself, to be fair. But he certainly, in the race conditions, just looked a little bit rusty. I mean, he got driving infringement penalties in both races. So I think that speaks volumes to that. We didn't see him make those sort of mistakes last year. But I think you've got to look too. Not only has he missed two supercars rounds, but compared to some of these other guys like a Will Brown or a Chaz Mostert, like they did the Bathurst 12-hour as well, and it had just come off a GT round at Phillip Island. So some of these guys are razor sharp in the groove, and Brody's come in from the bench cold. So, yeah, I think it was always going to be a bit of a tough assignment. It's hard to know how much the overall situation between driver and team there sort of plays into it too. It's sort of hard to imagine that a team can go through that much turmoil and bounce out the other side just as strong as they were last year. But I think Brody is just such a quality driver that I still reckon we'll see him win a couple of races this year.
Well, we saw some of, for want of a better term, the old Brody coming through over the course of the weekend. I mean, he made a bit of a shocker of a start to race two, which again, that's one of those things where I'm curious as to how many practice starts he did during that test day at Winton, because otherwise he wouldn't have done a proper start in a supercar since the end of the previous year. But then that racing brain switched back on and he clung to that tight line all the way around turn one and made up most of the spots that he lost. And then the shootout performance on the Sunday as well, to really not just make up a whole heap of spots, but really put his teammate Jack LeBrock in the shade. I think LeBrock kept a pretty reasonable account of himself up against Brody, but I would have expected him to be maybe slightly further ahead.
Yeah, I guess that's hard to say exactly, and we're commenting here from a long way away, but I feel like Jack's going to benefit quite a bit from having Brody back. I think Brody lifts the team direction and engineering-wise as well. His skills in that department are pretty well publicized. So, yeah, I think Jack showed some good signs on the weekend as well, and having Brody probably helps him along more than anything.
We've got a new segment this week off the back of the latest Supercars round, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Now, it's exactly what it says on the tin. We're going to rattle through a few of the people and the things from the weekend that fit under each of those headings. So we'll start with the good. Brad Jones Racing pit stops. I mean, there's a reason this team has won the Golden Rattle Gun, 11 times in succession now. They've got pretty much all of them, bar maybe one or two.
Even when they don't win it, Brad wrestles at least half the check off the winner. So, yes. Yeah.
I mean, their stops in the Saturday race, especially that first one to get Andre Heimgartner track position over Chaz Mostert, I mean, that basically won him the race, or went a fair way towards him winning the race, because that meant Chaz was on the back foot throughout the second stint. And then in the final round of stops, knowing that BJR were going to turn Andre around very quickly, come what may, it put enough pressure on Walkinshaw Andretti United that they fumbled Chaz's stop. So that AU Falcon practice rig that they've got in Albury, it's really paying for itself.
Oh, for sure. These guys, they always do a good job in the pit lane, but the overall story was the turnaround for BJR from the depths of where they were with all four cars at Albert Park, and they had some big issues to go away and solve, and they did. They went and did a rookie day with Jackson Evans at Queensland Raceway, which you're allowed to do under the rules, go outside of your normal testing venue, and they worked on all of that, and they clearly came back with a better package. And then there's also the element of Andre's own personal performance there on Saturday. He seemed to lift for the occasion like we used to see Murph do on home soil. Some drivers just really get up and about for that sort of stuff, and he was just sublime in the car. And then, yeah, also it's a new track. It's a surface that probably suited them a bit better than, say, in Albert Park, going by what we've seen before. And you know, this was BJR's first Gen 3 race win. It's taken them a long time to get that. But over history, they have tended to react well to new challenges. And a new racetrack like this is a new challenge for everyone to get their heads around. And they came out really strongly and obviously won that race.
The next team on the good list, it's Dick Johnson Racing and their rebound after what's been a pretty tough start to the season. They were great in the wet on Saturday, with Will Davison finishing second and Anton De Pasquale in third. Then Anton, of course, finishing third in the dry on the Sunday and winning the Jason Richards Memorial Trophy. Wilbur had a bit of a rougher day, but he reckoned he had top five pace for qualifying, but it just didn't work out for him. Do we think this is a genuine form improvement for DJR, or is this maybe just a situational thing with the new venue at Taupo?
Well, it's hard to say, and it's also tight that, you know, there's going to be a lot of up and down through the season. Certainly after Saturday, you'd say, okay, it was wet. It was sort of a unique situation, but then obviously they came back out on Sunday very strong, and they'd been quick right from Friday too. So I think one of the things about DJR in this Gen 3 era that they have been criticized for a bit is being sort of too locked into setups and mindsets around what worked on the old cars. And having had such success and such resource go into that Gen 2 program back when they had Penske and all of that stuff, it must have been tempting to sort of stick in the boxes that they knew. But again, when you come to a new racetrack, you're forced to start from scratch. Yeah. You're starting from zero. There's no last year's data. So, yeah, they were fast on Friday. Clearly, they did a good job of their prep, and they went on with it through the weekend.
Also in the good column from the weekend, Ryan Wood. You just mentioned, like, no previous data from going to a new track. It was a new track for all 24, well, basically the 24 driver field, certainly in terms of driving a Gen 3 supercar around it. And he really showcased what we all saw in the Super 2 series last year and the reasons why WAU promoted him to a main game seat this year.
Yeah, he's just fast, isn't he? Like, he's super exciting to watch. He's got a little bit of that Shane Van Gisbergen, like, when they're focused on him, you know something's going to happen, right? He's going to either try to make something happen and it'll work or it won't. And obviously, there was a couple of mistakes through the weekend that maybe cost him the podium on Saturday, and he made one in the shootout. And I think his tyre life probably wasn't quite as good as some others, which is why they went to that three-stopper on the Sunday. But he's just got that speed that you can't really teach a driver. So they've just got to hone it, and he'll get better with experience. I think when you look at this driver lineup at Walkinshaw's, you've got Chaz at 32 years old. He's really in the peak of his career now. This is the peak of his powers. And Ryan is just such a fast and raw talent. If you look in 1 or 2 years' time, like, this has the potential to be Walkinshaw's best driver lineup, going right back to the Lowndes and Scaife pairing, really. I think the ceiling of these two guys is that good.
Which then puts an additional spotlight over WAU to provide them the package to support the talent level.
Yeah, keep the wheels on it.
Yeah. And Ryan Wood, of course, walks away from the weekend with the lap record. So that is also worth noting.
Always a bit of a double-edged sword, because it probably means you cook the new tyre a bit hard.
Yes.
We've seen some blokes get some fastest life of the races before that, yeah, they probably wish they didn't.
Valid point. Also in the good column, James Golding. He's continued his quietly impressive season. He's 10th in the standings, but he's only 35 points out of fourth place. And he just, seemingly regardless of where he qualifies, he'll churn out a solid top 10 result.
Yeah, the two premier guys, James Golding and Tim Slade, had really sort of opposite weekends where James had two bad runs in quali and then came through in the races. And obviously, Tim made a couple of shootouts and didn't get a result out of it. So there's potential there. And obviously, James is gathering some points, but they're still just not quite executing the full race weekends. There's good signs. You know, there's a new sort of era of that team now with Stephen Robertson leading and Ludo Lacroix there, obviously, technically. But, you know, we're 18 months into Gen 3, and these guys, they're the only team not to have a podium.
Live pit lane format is the last thing in the good column that I had. I really thought that this whole live pit lane business, when it was floated last year, I thought it was going to be a giant waste of time. Maybe that's the traditionalist side of me coming out, but I'll be honest, I was completely wrong. It's added such, even just three rounds in, it's added some really interesting storylines and talking points into the season so far.
Yeah, it's certainly got a bit of attention. Like, personally, it just doesn't do that much for me talking about where people are going to be in pit lane at the next round, but I think the excitement of it will trail off a little bit too once we get to the mid-season and there's not so much, you know, DJR like gained however many spots in the pit lane. We won't see such a dramatic up and down once we get to the mid-season. I think if anything, this pit lane order discussion actually takes the focus away from the real pit lane issue, which is cars making contact in pit lane and just having a schmozzle like they had there on Saturday, which is dangerous, and it just looks amateur hour if nothing else. And that wasn't a small pit lane either. So this is a problem that they just continually get away with, for want of a better term.
Well, that neatly segs our way to the list of bad things from the weekend. Cam Waters' luck. What was the old Barry Sheen saying? If he had a duck, it'd drown. I mean, qualified on pole for the Saturday race, gets probably as good a start as you could possibly expect off the front row, given the conditions and the surface change immediately afterwards, and makes it all of about 50 metres up the road and ends up in the fence.
Yeah, that's obviously the last thing that Cam's season needed after a pretty rocky opening two rounds, and he did drag it back. Was it into the top 10 by the end of that race?
Yeah, yeah.
So even though it had a little bit of damage on it, it was still pretty fast. But, I mean, he leaves Taupo 15th in the championship. He's already 388 points down on the leader. Is he any chance of climbing back from that? I can't help but think that his title hopes for someone you had picked as the favourite are done.
He's leaving himself no opportunity to have any more bad weekends. I mean, that Saturday race, that given how Triple Eight fared that day, Brock Feeney finishing right down the back and a lap down, Will Brown finishing right down the order, that was a prime opportunity for him to claw back some of that margin, and he lost that opportunity within seconds of the start. It's very hard to see a way for Cam, especially when you see the form that Triple Eight showed when it was dry the next day. It's very hard to see how Cam comes back from this to even contend for the title, never mind win it.
Well, I'm sure there's still the potential to have a very good year, both winning some races here and some of that stuff he's doing in the US is pretty exciting too. So hopefully it gets better from here for him.
So we mentioned the next guy on this list of bad from the weekend, Tim Slade's luck. In fact, very, very intrinsic in Cam Waters' weekend, at least on the start of the Saturday race. Poor Sladey, he was fast in qualifying both days, and it all just unraveled for him.
Yeah, it was a shocker in terms of results, but at least he's fast. Like, when you look at where he'd come from after the Bathurst 500 to start the year, where he was just so perplexed by what was going on, how the car was reacting. He was just nowhere, and he'd struggled through the last half of last year. to have this speed to be qualifying for shootouts now, like that's a pretty decent turnaround. So I think he was a bit harshly criticised by some for that that lap one thing on Saturday. Like, you know, he got a great start and the gap was there when he went for it. And, you know, Will Brown's come over a long way as well. So they just kind of all converged. It was one of those sort of, start line deals that you hate to see. But certainly I was glad there was no, like, penalties for it or anything like that.
That's it. It was It's essentially a racing incident. Two people trying to go for what turned out to be the same spot in difficult conditions. It's worth noting that Tim Slade has out-qualified James Golding at five of the last six races as well. Finally, our last stop in this segment, the ugly from the weekend. Touched on it earlier, Chas Mostert's second pit stop on Saturday. Anytime a wheel comes loose from these cars when it's out on the racetrack, it is not a good thing. And I was genuinely not knowing where the fans or the stands or how the walls work at Taupo, I was genuinely concerned when that thing fired off the right rear corner of the 25 Mustang as to where it was going to end up. And that's not even looking at the impact it actually had on Chaz's opportunity to win that race.
Yeah, thankfully it was all okay from that side, and that's why teams get penalized for when wheels come off. Obviously, it always ruins their race pretty much anyway, but there's an extra case to answer to the stewards about why it happened. I think the unfortunate side from a sporting perspective was it really robbed us of that Chaz-Andre battle that was brewing. And Andre had a pretty good car. Like, it was fast in the right spots. It seemed to have good drive off the key corners that he was managing in. But it just felt like there was a little bit of Chaz magic to be sprinkled there in the final stint if he'd been able to have a crack at it, but unfortunately not.
Also from the Saturday race, we touched on the fact that Cam Waters and Tim Slade had a pretty rough lap one on Saturday. Grove Racing didn't have a much better one. I mean, Matt Payne, who'd been on provisional pole before the shootout, of course, slid down the grid due to the changeable conditions that presented themselves during that session. He slid off at turn one. I think from memory, he copped a bit of an assist to get there.
Yeah, I think Woody was in pretty hot down the inside and sort of bounced the DJR car into poor Matt Payne, his great mate.
Yeah, he wasn't alone in skiddling a couple of people down at turn one, lap one. At the other end of the grid, Richie Stanaway made a remarkable getaway from the last row of the grid. I think he passed three cars by the control line.
Yeah, I was watching Richie while all the stuff was unfolding at the front, because it looked like he'd been shot out of a cannon from the back of the grid.
Yeah, I was very pleasantly surprised to hear that he hadn't jumped the start, or at least no one was looking for it given everything that unfolded at the front of the field. And unfortunately, he ended up in the same sand trap that his teammate did.
He did, but then his drive back through the field was amazing, because in those early laps there, we ended up with like Richie and Matt and like Brock Feeney and obviously Cam were all down in that like P20 and beyond sort of range. And some heavy hitters trying to come back through, and Richie managed it the best of them.
The last entry in the ugly column, and I hate putting this team there because they had such a fantastic run at Albert Park and have really had a great season up until crossing the Tasman, but it's Matt Stone Racing. I mean, what happened? The wheels really fell off the fairy tale start to 2024 for them.
Yeah, it shows what a knife edge it is for Nick Percat to win that Sunday race at Albert Park. Such a great story around that. And then he goes to the next round and qualifies last for both races. That is, that's unbelievable. But on the Saturday there, like, Cam Hill put it in the shootout. I think he ended up sixth on the grid there. So it shows what a knife edge this whole thing is, especially in this Gen 3 era where everyone's got the same stuff and you've just got to try to maximize what you have, that if you miss it by a little bit, you can be a long way away.
So we were chatting about this beforehand because you flagged this question as to, has it happened previously in supercars history that the previous race winner has then gone on to qualify last at the following race, which Nick Percat unfortunately did at Taupo after winning the last race at Albert Park. We kicked this question to AN1 data guru Shane Rogers, and he came back with a very interesting list. It's happened more than I expected it to have. So most recently was actually Shane Van Gisbergen. He started last in Adelaide, the Saturday race at the Adelaide 500 in 2022, having won at the Gold Coast. Anton Di Pasquale did it during that run of four consecutive events, the quad header at Sydney Motorsport Park in 2021. He won race one of event two and then started last in the next race after doing a transaxle in quali. Craig Lowndes had the 2015 title on the line at Homebush and had won the last race at Phillip Island at the previous round, but made a mistake late in qualifying for race one at Sydney Olympic Park and started that race last. And the other two instances, Jim Richards started last at Amaru in 1991, having won at Winton. I think he detonated an engine in Godzilla that weekend, and that's why he was off the back. And in 1974, similar sort of thing, same venue actually, Alan Moffat started last at Amaru, having won at Sandown, and also had an engine go in his Falcon during, I think, a preliminary race, and he ended up hopping into Fred Gibson's car.
Well, you've managed to flip the narrative on this. I'm now saying well done to Nick Percat. When you look at the names on that list, that's a list that I reckon you'd be proud to be a part of.
Around the world now, Formula One made its return to China last weekend, and Max Verstappen can now say he's won a Formula One race there too. The reigning world champ was untouchable in both the sprint and the Grand Prix, with McLaren's Lando Norris emerging as the best of the rest on Sunday, in second place from Verstappen's Red Bull teammate Sergio Perez. It was a sour day for the Aussies, who both copped damage in a bizarre concertina at the final hairpin as the safety car period came to an end during the race. Oscar Piastri sustained damage to the back of his McLaren that hampered his pace for the rest of the run, but it was caused by the nose of Daniel Ricciardo's RB, which was hit from behind so hard by Lance Stroll that it lifted the back of Ricciardo's car completely off the ground and caused so much damage that he had to retire almost immediately. Stroll copped a penalty, which he labelled a joke, and after the race suggested it was Ricciardo's mistake that caused it, something that Dan didn't really take kindly to.
He's saying my mistake? Okay, I had started to calm down, but now that makes me... that pisses me off, because I watched his onboard. He's not even looking at me. We start to brake and his head starts looking at the corner, and then he starts to accelerate or come off the brake, and then he's right underneath me. So that pisses me off.
Audio from Canal Plus there. In WRC, Sebastian Ogier won Rally Croatia for Toyota, inheriting the win on the final day after both Hyundai's Thierry Neuville and Ogier's teammate Elfyn Evans lost time through separate crashes on the same stage. Evans recovered to finish second with Neuville third, although the Belgian does retain the world championship lead. IndyCar raced on the streets of Long Beach and Scott Dixon put on another clinic, blending fuel saving with speed to capture his 57th career victory from Colton Herta and Alex Palou. Will Power came home sixth after starting on the front row, while Scott McLaughlin was running inside the top 10 when he was forced out with a late gearbox issue. And congrats to Scotty and wife Carly, who announced they're going to become parents later this year. And Shane Van Gisbergen got his first taste of the NASCAR Cup Series on an oval, pulling double duty at Talladega over the weekend. He was running an incredible fourth in the Xfinity Series race, but ran out of fuel during the first attempt at a green-white checker finish and fell to 22nd. In the Cup Series race the next day, he briefly led the race on a couple of occasions, but was shuffled out late in the going and wound up 26th at the checkered flag. Ford looked poised to break its Cup Series duck for 2024, only for Michael McDowell and Brad Keselowski to tangle on the run to the flag, handing the win to Toyota's Tyler Reddick, and marking the first time that 2311 co-owner Michael Jordan has been trackside for a Cup Series win. Motorsport News mailbag time, and Brody Taylor asks, if New Zealand does get a second date, what track is in the best shot of getting the second round, aside from Hampton Downs? Now, it's something that had been speculated about, had been hoped for heading into this weekend, and on the eve of the round itself, Barclay Nettlefold, the CEO of Supercars, went on, I think it was New Zealand radio, and discussed the fact that he is super keen to have a second round in New Zealand. But unfortunately, logistically, how's this going to work in terms of what event can cater to the sort of crowd accommodation, logistical demands that a supercars event needs, but not be too physically close to Taupo.
Yeah, so it's can they add a second one without hurting the first one?
Yes.
That's really the
question. That's a much neater way of what I just rambled my way through, so thank you.
And I think that that's where the Hampton Downs thing, as much as Tony Quinn has spoken about wanting to do a Hampton and Taupo double, they are too close. Like, they're only 200 kilometres or something apart. Like, everyone was flying into Auckland and driving past Hampton Downs to go to Taupo. So, I really feel like they would take crowd from one another if you tried to do that on back-to-back weekends. And I think there's some other issues there at Hampton around the resource consent and the crowd capacity and all that stuff as well. So, just aside from that, the ideal scenario really is one in the North Island and one in the South. And I think you look down south and Highlands Park, like, that's got to be the one. It's another Quinny track. It'd need a lot of work to be able to host a major event like Supercars, both from a track facility for the team's point of view and from a fan point of view. But again, it's a Quinny circuit. It's not too far from Queenstown, so it has that tourism element that Taupo has.
Mm.
And yeah, to be able to do a doubleheader, there's all sorts of talk about all elements of this at the moment, including do they sea freight the trucks over, maybe just the B trailers, because the A trailers really carry a lot of the pre-marked tyres and things like that that the teams don't take to New Zealand anyway. So if you have the trucks over there, then you can drive them down from Taupo to Highlands or wherever it is, and just create a big PR blitz in that week. It'd just be mega. There's so many possibilities for that. But again, like all these things, it needs to be funded. And that's where the New Zealand government would have to step up, I'd imagine.
And I mean, you mentioned that being close to Queenstown, I think Virgin Australia fly direct into Queenstown. Quite a few carriers in Australia do. So if you only wanted to do one of the weekends, that's quite achievable. And I think I looked at a map before and Queenstown's, what, an hour away from Highlands, which realistically, I lived in Sydney for quite a few years and it never took me anywhere anything close to less than an hour to get to Sydney Motorsport Park. So I don't think if you wanted to stay in and around Queenstown, I don't think that's too far to go.
Oh, when I drove from Highlands back to Queenstown, when I was there, it felt like the longest hour of my life because I forgot to refuel the thing beforehand, and there ain't too many petrol stations along the way, I'll give the tip. But oh, it's a great part of the world, awesome place. Like, in terms of getting people to travel to go to a race meeting, you couldn't ask for anywhere better to go than down that part.
There you go, Barclay. We have solved that problem for you. Now, before we go, a reminder to check out our teammates' podcasts here on the Motorsport News podcast feed. Tomorrow, Peter and Luke Whitten from Rally Sport Magazine are back with a new episode of the Special Stage Rally podcast, talking about all things rallying, both here and around the world. And keep your eyes peeled for the next edition of the Brad Jones Racing Rundown, hosted by BJR General Manager Chris Westwood and the driver of the number 96 Wendy's Camaro, Macaulay Jones. But for now, on behalf of Stefan Bartholomaeus, I'm Will Dale, and we'll catch you next time on the Motorsport News Podcast.
Hey, it's Chaz Mostert here, and yes, I'm inside your speaker. I'm in here because I have a special message for you from Clayton in Melbourne. If you're a club, state, or national racer on the circuit or on the dirt in Speedway or rallying, you can now tap into the know-how of Walkinshaw Racing Services, and you don't need a supercar to get in the door. The same expertise that's won multiple Bathurst 1000s and V8 Supercar Championships is now available for you to call upon. From bonnet to bumper, WRS can help you with engines, design, paint, machining, fabrication, and so much more for all sorts of makes, models, and categories. Have a chat with Walkinshaw Racing Services and tell them what matters to you. Call now on 1300 W Racing or email services@walkinshawracing.com.au.